because it mixes strange, it can turn a strange down bar state into an S bar D state, it mixes kaons and anti-kaons. And that's an effect that's very interesting to measure and to understand theoretically, because as you saw in tutorial, once you have some off-diagonal term in the mass matrix, now this is a little funny. Usually in field theory, we're using the relativistic normalization for the states. And then when you go to the quantum mechanics problem, you're using a non-relativistic normalization. There's an overall factor of mass that you always have to add in to correct for that. So when we put in our effective Hamiltonian, and then this isn't the mass difference. The mass difference, it's the mass difference times mk. But if you were to use the non-relativistic normalization of the states, you could just drop him altogether. Once you have this off-diagonal term in the mass matrix, so you have some diagonal mass, which is due to QCD, and to the strange quark mass, and then, sorry, I know that's small. And then you have some new off-diagonal terms, both sides coming from this operator and its conjugate. That now breaks the degeneracy between the two states. It mixes you into states that approximately, neglecting CP violation, look like K0 plus or minus K0 bar, which we call K long, you know, over square root of 2 if I want to normalize them properly, K long or K short, different masses. That mass difference can be measured by the oscillation in the number of K longs versus K shorts over time, as the system time evolves. So this has been measured very precisely. It's very small, and we want to understand whether, yeah. Right. So we want to understand this mixing matrix, check whether the mass difference that we get from the standard model is at all consistent with what's seen in the lab. That's difficult to do because the standard model calculation in full is very complicated, but we can at least do some dimensional analysis with some of the simplest diagrams, see if it's in the right ballpark. And then try to understand what bounds that very small mass difference sets on physics beyond the standard model. So I'll try to do both of those things today. So what I would like to do is first calculate, so first I'll just remind you, I wanted to write this down before everybody got here, but then we had a quorum. So I started the class that if I have an operator, and I'm going to put a little coefficient z on top of the lambda squared here, times s bar left sigma bar mu d left squared k naught bar, we obviously have a z over lambda squared factor that we can just pull out. And then we're left with this KK bar matrix element. The way we can estimate that is what I did late in yesterday's class, this vacuum insertion, right? And then you find that this is just related to that the expectation value for just the operator, I've pulled the coefficient out, related to the K on decay constant, Fk squared, times Mk squared, times some coefficient of order 1, which I'll call B. So if we can estimate this coefficient, Z over lambda squared in the standard model, then we can estimate, using these two formulas, we can estimate the K on mass difference.
So when we did the vacuum insertion,
Right. So the vacuum insertion was just once I have this operator with some coefficient to be determined, what's the effect of that operator on the K-on mass matrix? Now we can back up and ask, well, how do I get that operator in the first place? Or said differently, what is the z over lambda squared from the standard model? Then the second question, what kind of z over lambda squared would you expect from beyond the standard model, from new physics? And of course, I can't possibly hope to calculate anything unless I put in some models here, specific models. So we'll do that. So those are the two things that I want to do today. Oh, wow. This is why I use the manual version. Okay, so what kinds of diagrams can generate that operator in the standard model? Well, we know we've got to have our S bar and our D coming in, S and D bar coming in. Let me write them the other way. Y, S and D bar coming out. There's no interaction that these two share directly. There's no S bar D coupling to the Z, for example. But they both couple to the W. So I can put in some W lines. And if I have, say, a W plus coming in this way, then I might expect to get an up quark here. Now, there is a small up quark coupling to the strange quark through another W. I can connect these through a W. And here I can put, say, a U bar. Each of the vertices in this diagram is non-zero. So this one, sort of order one, it's proportional. Remember, I'm working in the mass eigenstate basis, where there's the CKM matrix element determining the coupling of each pair of quarks to the W. So this would be a VUD. This would be a VUS dagger. It's very likely that I'm changing my conventions of what's V and what's V dagger from yesterday's lecture, but the end result's the same. This is a VUS and a VUD, and I believe, let's see. Yeah, I believe the daggers are the same in both cases. Okay. Not 100% sure on that. Now, let's look at this. So this is one diagram we can write down. If you try to estimate the rate for this one, for this one diagram, so I basically just have to do this loop integral, d4k. Each of my w propagators is going to give me something that goes like 1 over mw squared, 1 over k squared minus mw. And I have two of those. And then my up quark's essentially massless. Each of my up quark lines is going to give me a k slash over k squared minus m up squared. And I have two of those. And then there's other gamma matrices as well. Each one of these is contracted into a gamma matrix. So really, the full gamma matrix structure isn't just two k slashes. It's like a gamma k slash, gamma k slash. But we actually don't need all of that to do the dimensional analysis, just this level, right? You see that this is this at high momenta, at momenta larger than the W mass, this has Each of these has two powers of momentum in the denominator, so this goes like a 1 over k to the fourth. This has two k's in the denominator, but also in each term, but also one in the numerator. So this will go like a k squared over k to the fourth. On the whole, then, the integrand at large momenta goes like 1 over k to the sixth. So that's going to be very convergent, and it's going to be, and the integral is going to be dominated at k squared of order mw squared. I should also keep track of my coupling coefficients in front of this, right? So I have my VUD VUS dagger squared. And I have, sorry, also here at each one of these a G2. Because it's a weak interaction. So I have my G2 to the fourth multiplying it. And I would expect, after doing my integral, to end up with an alpha 2 squared from the weak interactions. And then 1 over... mw squared. Times my CKM matrix elements. That would be the guess based on dimensional analysis looking at this diagram alone. That's not the right answer, but that's the guess so far, one diagram at a time. And what that would tell us, we did just the one diagram, is that the lifetime, when we now look at, sorry, the splitting, this would tell us that delta mk squared should now go like fk squared over mw squared times alpha 2 squared VUD VUS dagger squared. And if you estimate this, this is much bigger. This is delta mk squared over mk squared. Really, delta mk over mk. I'll just stick to that. This is much bigger than the 10 to the minus 12 that is actually measured. This is too big. And, well, maybe it's too big because we forgot some diagrams that interfere with this one. Right? So I put in the up quark, but I could have also put in a charm quark. Now I have, just including these two, I have four different diagrams, the up-up, charm-charm, up-charm, and charm-up. I could also put in a top quark. Its mass is sufficiently heavier that you might expect it not to matter very much, but I can also put in a top quark. Now, what do I have here? Instead of this VUD-VUS dagger, I have to sum over I, VID, VIS dagger. And then I have to do a separate sum over J, VJD, VJS dagger. Now, the CKM matrix, these are just CKM matrix elements, right? So now this is, if I write it as a matrix element, so that this looks like a matrix multiplication, I'd write it this way. It's a V dagger V matrix SD component. If I'm summing over all I, up, charm, and top. But that is V was a unitary matrix. So this inside thing, that's the identity matrix. It's an off-diagonal component of the identity matrix. So that's just zero. That's what's called, well, the collection of all applications of the of this unitarity to standard model processes and the resulting sort of suppression from this naive answer. So I just basically, that this suppression is called the Jim mechanism. After Glashow, Eliopoulos, and Maiani, who were the first to propose that adding a charm quark to the very young standard model that didn't have a charm quark yet would solve lots of problems with disagreements with experiment and the theory, and in particular, the flavor-changing neutral currents. This is an example of a loop-level flavor-changing neutral current because the charge of the left and the right is the same, and the flavors are different. So that's a flavor-changing neutral current. So when I basically, at the level of the diagram I just did, let's say I ignored the top quark completely. That's the simplest approximation. So I just have up and charm, intermediate states. And then my V matrix would have been very simple. There would have been a cos theta, sine theta, minus sine theta, cos theta. You can always parametrize it in this way. So when I looked at the up-down, this is up-down, up S, charm down, charm S. When I looked at the up loop, I would have a VUD, VUS dagger. That's just cos theta, sine theta. This is from the ups. And just in each leg, right? Never mind, even if I just focus on the top bar of the graph. So now I just have to sum over either up or charm. When I look at the charm pieces, it's going to be, so this is VUD, VUS, dagger. When I look at VCD, VCS, dagger, well, VCD is just minus sine theta times cos theta. Clearly, these sum to zero. So my leading order estimate, turns out it has a factor that has to multiply it, and that factor is zero. So now we need to look for the next smallest term that could contribute. And the key to the fact that there are larger terms is from the mass squared. Okay, so if I have now, I really have an M up. So sorry, first, why is it zero? When things are zero, there should be a really nice reason for their zeroness. Everything that can happen generally in field theory does happen unless there's a symmetry protecting it. So what's the symmetry responsible for this? Well, it's the fact that we're essentially taking the massless limit for the quarks, right? Or a degenerate mass limit for the quarks, so that I don't care about the differences in the plus mi or the differences from integrating over the mi squareds in the denominator. In that limit that I can ignore the masses of the up and charm quarks, that's like setting y up to zero. I would have been free to rotate my basis here away from, I wanted to work in a mass eigenstate basis so that I'd have mass eigenstates in my propagators. If all the masses were the same, well, now I have an enhanced U2 symmetry of rotating the up-type quarks. I can rotate away the whole CKM matrix and just work in a basis where these were strictly diagonal couplings. So that's just telling me that I better expect. In other words, this calculation, I could have known it was wrong just from the symmetry rules that we discussed earlier, just from the fact that I'm not using the up-type masses anywhere. And you know you needed up-Yukawa dependence in the answer. Yeah.
Is this correct to think of it this following way, that the fact that we're setting all the masses to equal to each other means that the mass dependent term factor in each of this term kind of factors out, and then the rest is a unitary, is zero by unitarity?
Yes. So if I had all non-zero masses, but equal masses, this is the case that you're talking about, then I could, even then the I dependence here, I can forget about it. I can just pull out this factor, sum over I of him times the same integral in each case. Because it's the same integral in each case, I can just do this sum outside the integral, and it's my unitary matrix, an off-diagonal component of unitary-unitary dagger. And so it would vanish. The difference can only come from summing over these mass differences inside of the integral. And when you do that, a heuristic way of estimating what the effects will be, albeit not a very satisfying one when you start thinking carefully about left and right-handed quarks, but a heuristic argument for the expectation is to just look at this first rung, the top rung, and we can see this cancellation in action. So here I have my VIS dagger, and here I have my VID. And that piece of the loop integral goes like a sum over I, VIS dagger, k slash plus mi over k squared, and then everything else is higher order in mass, so I'm going to ignore it, times vid. The k slash term, that's plus dot dot dot. The k slash term, I can use my unitarity to say that. Well, so let me actually keep my mi squared a little longer. So I can use the unitarity in just the charm quark term. I can write this. Let's say I just want to sum over 1 and 2 and ignore the top mass piece. Then I'm left with, I have a V US dagger, k slash over k squared. The up mass is really small, so I can just ignore it. V ds, sorry, V vud, plus I have my k slash plus m charm over k squared plus m charm squared, times, and now I'm going to use unitarity, I'm going to use V is VID equals 0 when summed over I, to write the coefficient of the charm term as minus VUS dagger VUD minus VTS dagger VTD. This term is quite small, not completely negligible, but I can get the right answer, the order of magnitude, if I ignore it. And this term now is clearly going to almost cancel off of this term. And it leaves me with a remaining term that's proportional to VUS dagger VUD times M charm over K squared, rather than a k slash over k squared. Now, I was evaluating my integral before at k squared of order mw squared. The integral is still going to be evaluated at k squared over mw squared. And it has two of these factors, each of them order m charm. So now, my new estimate for that matrix element, when I sum over up and down, is going to be, so my c over lambda squared for the full standard model. Well, not the full standard model because I'm not including every type of correction, but at least the full box diagram. So I'll say full box is equal to my C over lambda squared for the up box, which I calculated up there, times the suppression, which is just the charm mass squared over the typical momentum of that integral, mw squared. So there's an extra suppression that I left out that comes from the enhanced, from the symmetry of the problem, and from the fact that the up and charm quarks are both very nearly massless compared to the weak scale, which is the momentum scale of the interactions. So when you do the estimate with that factor included, let's see what it is. Let's see what, so now I say delta m k on over m k on, putting it all together, goes like fk squared over mw squared. M charm squared over mw squared. And then I'm left with my alpha 2 squared times v up strange, v d dagger, or other way around, squared. This is order 1. VUS of order 0.2. I'm going to have a 0.2 squared. Alpha 2 is around a 20th. The charm is about a jev. W is about 100 jev. So this is about 10 to the minus 4. And then this is 100 MeV to 100 GeV, 10 to the minus 6. I can call this, since this is 1 over 20th, this is 1 over a fifth. I can call these together another 10 to the minus 4. And the rough size that you'd get from this estimate is therefore around 10 to the minus 14, which is in very good, which is the right order of magnitude for the actual observed kaon mass splitting. So very simple estimates get the answer very wrong if you forget about the symmetries of the system, and pretty much right on if you don't forget about the symmetries of the system, if you use them. Yeah. Ah, sorry. Unfortunately, this is the backboard. So I can write it over there. So what's buried, just the right-hand side of the calculation of delta mk over mk? Sorry about that. So delta mk over mk, according to my estimates earlier. So I had my, before, I had my fk over mw squared. This was from the original estimate, times by CKM factors, VUD, VUS, with one of them daggered, squared. I had my alpha 2 squared from all the weak couplings in the diagram. And lastly, there was this extra symmetry suppression factor, the M charm over MW squared. And then I just estimated the size of each of these. This is 100 MeV over 100 GeV squared. So that's 10 to the minus 6. The VUD is very close to 1. VUS is about 0.2, so that's a fifth squared. Alpha 2 is about a 20th squared. And M charm over MW is 1 jev over 100 jev squared. So very roughly, if I put these together, this is 10 to the minus 6, 4 10 to the minus 2, a fourth 10 to the minus 2, and a 10 to the minus 4. If I put these all together, I get a delta mk over mk of about 10 to the minus 14. Now, there are many terms that contribute to this process. There's this, there's the loop the box diagram I drew. There's a different orientation of box diagram. There's other processes that you should really think of not so much as short distance, but long distance QCD effects of the mixing. Like if you want to talk about the effects of the pion decay, of the fact that both kaons can decay into pi pi, that induces the mixing. Well, that's something you really have to think about in terms of an intermediate on-shell state, something that can propagate long distances. That's a very different calculation at the level of perturbation theory. So there's the so-called long distance. Contributions. But they do all share this scaling. And considering that we got a number here, 10 to the minus 14, versus, which is within, which is the right order of magnitude, versus your sort of naive symmetry-less dimensional analysis guess of alpha 2 squared over mw squared, or your slightly less naive, your slightly less naive analysis where you take into account the mixing angles, but you don't take into account the symmetry suppression. There's many orders of magnitude difference between this essentially correct answer and the most naive things that you'd get just by scaling without including the detailed structure of the standard model. Yeah. Right. So we could have added a top term, and it would have just given us a k slash plus m top over k squared plus m top squared times. And so again, I would have had a difference of two terms, the charm term and the top term, with this coefficient. This coefficient, though, is much smaller than that coefficient. And although you don't get the same level of cancellation because the top mass is big, this term's also suppressed because at the W mass scale, this is still suppressed by M top because the top's significantly heavier than the W. So the top contribution, it's not negligible, but it winds up being subdominant. And since all we were trying to do is a scaling estimate anyway, working with the focusing on the first two flavors, turns out to be the right answer. There was no guarantee of that. If the mixing angle with the top had been significantly larger than it actually is, we couldn't have ignored this coefficient or the top term. We would have had to take that into account. But certainly, of the two terms controlled by this coefficient, the one from the charm and the one from the top, the charm guy is going to be the more important because he doesn't have the m tops in the denominator. All right. So that's the standard model source of this flavor mixing. Now, what happens beyond the standard model? So one example theory that we can look at is supersymmetry. And I'm not going to try to lay out the whole supersymmetric standard model, because actually one of the sort of interesting things is that you can think about even just small parts of a supersymmetric extension, they already give you flavor violation. So I'm talking about something involving left-handed down and strange quarks. In a supersymmetric theory, we know minimally these guys have partners. Strange quarks and down squarks. And how do these partners talk to each other? Well, remember, this was now a week or two ago, but remember, Itai was discussing that in addition to every fermion having a partner, it's also true that in order to write down gauge interactions in a supersymmetric theory, the gauge bosons had to have a partner. So when you look at a theory with just a photon, a mu, there's some fermion, lambda, called the Gaugino, that it has to, that has to have related couplings, right? And in particular, when I have matter charged under my gauge, charged under my gauge field, so that I have an interaction S bar left, sigma dot A, S left, that implies, first of all, it implies that this squark, its superpartner, has gauge interactions too. I have my del plus IA S squared and the two types of gauge interactions that that gives rise to. So I have gauge interactions for the scalar. Just diagrammatically, I would say that if these are my matter lines, and I'll use purple for gauge bosons, and nobody can see the difference between purple and white. So I'll use orange for the gauge boson. So this interaction implies that my squarks, my down squark, for example, would have to have gauge interactions, as well as the two-photon interaction. In addition, supersymmetry requires some common interactions of the gaugino that are related to the gauge interactions. And the interaction that's required by supersymmetry is that the gaugino has a coupling to the quark, between the quark and the squark. And if this has some coupling G, then this also has a coupling G times proportional to G times all the usual momentum dependence for a scalar gauge interaction. This has a coupling G squared. And this also has a coupling G. So this should remind you a little bit, in terms of symmetry structure, it should remind you a little bit of the weak interactions, the charged currents, because it's a gauge interaction that's relating two different types of matter. It's relating, instead of relating up-type quarks to down-type quarks, it's connecting scalar matter to fermionic matter. So we might expect that this kind of thing can produce flavor violation. Now, not yet. As you know, so this plays a role that's similar in structure to the weak interact, to the W plus or minus interactions. Okay, it's analogous to the W plus minus interactions in the standard model that mixed the up and the down type. Now, in the standard model, we also, to get flavor violation, needed up Yukawas and down Yukawas. We're talking here about down type quarks. They certainly know about their own down Yukawas. But what about these squark masses? So how much did Itai talk about Susie breaking? Mm-hmm. Not at all. Okay. So I should break supersymmetry very fast because we're running out of time, but you need it broken for the tutorial. So I think all of you are made up of constituent fermions, right? Are any of you made out of bosons? Any of you made out of superpartners? You sure? Okay. So we don't have light bosons around in the world that we can make stuff out of. We don't have a nearly massless strange squark or down squark or any other kind of squark or a gaugino, right? All we have are light fermions. So supersymmetry is broken in the real world. If we want to protect all of the sort of very nice features of supersymmetry, that it helps solve the hierarchy problem by canceling quadratic divergences, because loops of squarks cancel the effects of loops of quarks on things like the Higgs mass term. You guys remember that? Good. In order to save that, we can't go around breaking supersymmetry badly by doing things like changing this coupling from being proportional to G to being proportional to G times you know, 1.3. That would show up badly and affect all of those nice loop level miracles. What one can do is break supersymmetry by mass terms. That's called soft breaking. So we can add mass terms that violate SUSY symmetry. So I still have to respect all the gauge symmetries of the standard model. I could try adding mass terms to fermions and not bosons. But for these standard model fermions, that doesn't work very well because they're chiral, right? There's nobody in the standard model that I can form a mass term, S left, X right with, because there's no X with the right with the opposite quantum numbers as the strange quark in the standard model. So there's no fermion masses that I can write down as far as matter fermions, but I can write down new scalar masses. I can write down a mass term, S left star, S left tilde. So this is just a squark. This is just a phi mod squared for a scalar, except I'm calling my scalar by a fancier name. Now, I'd be silly to do this just for the strange squark, right? This is a little artificial. It's not even gauge invariant, because the strange squark's related to an uptype squark. The general thing I can do is I can write down some mass matrix times the left-handed squark I, left-handed squark J, star. So I star one of them. Now I've written down a mass term for all my left-handed, all the partners of the left-handed quarks. I could do the same thing for the right-handed quarks with different mass terms. Again, IJ indices, and this is a matrix. And for the down type, and for the leptons, for the sleptons, etc. That's one kind of supersymmetry breaking that I can write down that, at least to a good approximation, at least above the mass scale, preserves all of the nice all the nice properties that motivated us to add supersymmetry to the theory anyway. So this is called soft breaking, and this is how you break supersymmetry in the squark sector, the slepton sector. This explains why you guys aren't, or at least so you claim, aren't made up of squarks or sleptons. They're made up of quarks and leptons, because these are much too heavy. All right, but what about gluinos? Well, we want our gluinos to be heavy too. How do we make our gluinos heavy? Again, we're trying to break supersymmetry. We aren't going to give the gluon mass because we're pretty sure the gluon doesn't have mass. But we can give the gluino mass. The gluino we can give mass. The gluino and all the other gauginos. But I'm going to focus on the gluino just because it's the most strongly interacting of them. So I have 8 gluinos. They have an index A, which runs from 1 to 8 over the adjoint of SU3. I can do a sum over A, lambda lambda. So this is, and then I can put a mass term out in front of it. This is a Majorana mass. We talked a little bit about this earlier, right? Same particle on the left and the right. Some linear mass term. It's the other kind of term that I can add to my theory that breaks supersymmetry. So once we've added all of these, In particular, now, it turns out, just forgetting about everything else, if I focus on the left-handed quarks mass matrix and this Luino mass and this gauge interaction here, right, this Gaugino interaction that was related by supersymmetry to my gauge interactions. In the case of the super partner of the strong interaction, so this is the Gluino interaction, that's enough to lead to flavor violation. Because I have, instead of having left-handed and right-handed things, left-handed and right-handed symmetries that are broken, I have quark symmetries and squark symmetries that are broken. This interaction relates a particular quark to a particular squark. There's some diagonal, there's some basis in which these matrices are, these couplings are diagonal, but in a generic basis, they're not diagonal, just like the W couplings. This mass term singles out a certain basis where the squark masses are diagonal. Y down, we already know, singles out a basis where the quark masses are diagonal. And in general, these bases aren't expected to mesh together. So that is what gives us flavor violation and supersymmetry. So in the tutorial today, we've worked out some problems for you to essentially go through the same kind of analysis that I've been doing for the standard model with these squark mass matrices instead, and show that even without considering up Yukawas, et cetera, just the squark masses, if this is some generic matrix, just the squark masses can actually give you much larger K-on mixing than you'd get from the standard model. That places a tight constraint on what form these mass matrices actually take. So for example, so there's certainly some resolutions of that. I'm going to skip the calculations for now, because I hope the context is clear. So if, does anybody have any questions though about this Susie breaking proposal that I made for how it works? So you say Itai didn't talk about mass terms like this at all. Okay. So this is probably a little unfamiliar then.
Well, he kind of mentioned Majorana mass
terms. Okay.
Nothing kind of in an organized way that supersymmetry supersymmetry breaking mechanisms were not discussed.
Yeah. Right, so that's a really good question. So these soft terms, if I just write them down and I posit that they're part of the theory, they do break supersymmetry. Now, and they break it in a nice way that preserves that keeps the hierarchy problem essentially solved, provided those masses are small enough. Now usually what people think is probably, you know, it would in some sense, if the true theory of nature just has small mass terms there, 1 TeV. And then there's a fundamental scale of Planck scale, 10 to the 19 GeV. And those terms just happen to all be small and all be comparable. That's formally consistent, but it feels like you've replaced the problem with an almost equally big problem, right? It's not as big because the Higgs mass, setting the Higgs mass to be 100 GeV was unstable to radiative corrections. You put in m Higgs squared. It's your tree level m Higgs squared plus some delta m Higgs squared in the standard model. And in the standard model, with the addition of some, if there's any physics at high scales, then this is sort of is proportional to your high mass scale squared. If I plug in an M squark, that's one TeV, and I calculate what's the correction to the squark mass from high mass scale physics, if that high mass physics is also supersymmetric, then I would get M squark squared is equal to the tree level M squark squared plus, again, some quantum corrections, delta M squark squared. But now this isn't proportional to my high mass scale anymore. It's proportional to M squark squared. So this is called technically natural and this technically unnatural, because you could imagine a theory where this is set to be small at high scales, and it stays small. Quantum corrections don't spoil its smallness. Whereas here, I really need to fine-tune the tree-level calculate thing against a large quantum correction in order to get a small physical mass. So there is a difference. This is definitely a less abhorrent small number than this small number. But it's still a small number that you had to put into the theory by hand. And there's no reason to think that it had to be put into the theory by hand. So there are many models, which we won't really talk about, where supersymmetry is broken spontaneously, just like in the standard model, electroweak symmetry is broken spontaneously. There's some spontaneous supersymmetry breaking somewhere else. And when you couple that spontaneous symmetry breaking to the standard model, it generates these mass terms. These models actually give you, in some cases, fairly sharp predictions for the relations between different mass terms. If we were to see supersymmetry and start finding that, you know, discover that these particles are there, start measuring their masses, then you could start testing those models, understanding which ones have the right structure to explain the data and which ones don't. Right now, we're nowhere near that point. You see, supersymmetry may or may not actually be a correct theory of nature. Who knows what the superpartner's masses are? So it's a little premature to start spending lots of time understanding what predictions different models make about how one mass term for a particle that hasn't been seen is related to another mass term for a particle that hasn't been seen. And so that's why I'm focusing instead on questions like, what can we learn about these mass terms from systems like kaons, which have been seen and studied very precisely? Because we can actually learn quite a bit about those mass terms from flavor physics. So the general story, sorry, this was a very long answer to your question, because there were a few tangents I wanted to go on anyway. We can put these couplings in by hand. These couplings do break supersymmetry. They break it in a controlled way that preserves the cancellation of quadratic divergences in the supersymmetric standard model. We can either imagine that they're put in by hand, or more compellingly, more plausibly, imagine that they come from some dynamics, some other sector of nature that spontaneously breaks supersymmetry, and the spontaneous breaking gives rise to those couplings. But for purposes of doing low energy calculations, we don't need to know where they came from. We just need to know what the effect of, or parametrize the effect of masses and study their consequences. Sure. So this is something that you guys will work out in more detail in the tutorial as well. But the gist is that if the first thing to say is that if the squark matrix here, I should think of it as having two pieces, right? I should think of it, it's got a squark and an anti-squark. So I could write this to be some delta ij times an m1 squared plus some traceless thing, I'll call it m hat squared ij. And I can do this decomposition. This isn't a decomposition that made a lot of sense when we were talking about mass terms that related an up quark to a down quark, Because they had different symmetries. I could do one kind of rotation, or a left-handed to a right-handed quark. The free theory had a symmetry that let me rotate them separately. There was no invariant meaning to putting in a delta function. Here, because these are a quark and an anti-quark, the delta function has a meaning, right? The delta function is singled out by the fact that when I do any basis rotation on the squark, the delta would go to a V dagger delta V, which, since this is a delta, commutes through the V, and since this is unitary, is just delta, right? So this is invariant under flavor rotations. This is non-invariant under flavor rotations. There are theories of super, the reason I'm emphasizing this is that there are theories of supersymmetry where this is non-zero, and this is zero or very small, or proportional, or naturally proportional to a y up dagger y up kind of behavior, okay, where it's tied to standard model flavor and where this dominates. If I think about this term dominating, in those theories, there's actually no flavor violation because this doesn't break any symmetry. Only this guy broke the symmetry. And so when you work out what are the symmetry breaking mechanisms that would allow me to induce that operator, they all end up proportional to this. So that's one important feature to note. In terms of the kinds of processes that you'd write down, so you could think about a diagram like this. Here's my gluino, which I called lambda over there. You can also call it a gluino. My S bar D. And now it's the same kind of story that I had over there. Instead of putting quarks in here, I'm putting squarks in, because this is a gluino. This is just that interaction. And here I have a mass matrix that mixes the squark that couples to the strange, right? The flavor, so there's still this notion of flavor interaction eigenstates. There's a sort of strange type squark and a down type squark. But actually the mass eigenstate's a linear combination of the two, if you have this kind of term. And that mass eigenstate being a linear combination is what actually leads to flavor violation there. All right, if anybody has more questions, well, I have a talk to go to, so I should actually run. But if you guys have more questions and want to find me.